Are you ready to make the most of your oil and gas mineral rights? Welcome to the Mineral Rights Podcast. Get the knowledge and resources you need to manage your minerals and royalties. Here is your host, Matt Sands.
Hello and welcome to the Mineral Rights Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Sands, and I'm here to help you make the most of your mineral rights and royalties. And Justin Williams is with me here as always. Hey, Justin.
Hey, good morning, Matt. One of our last shows here of 2020.
Yeah, one of the last shows. It's hard to believe that the year is almost over. It's been a crazy year, like we were talking about before we hit record. Lots of ups and lots of downs, but things are looking up.
That's right.
So this is our final episode for 2020 for the Mineral Rights Podcast, which is really exciting. Like I mentioned, I can't believe the year is almost over, and it's probably not happening soon enough for many. It definitely has been a challenging year. We had oil futures going negative for the first time ever. We had the economic collapse associated with the coronavirus and loss of loved ones for many of us. And so definitely been some challenges, but things are looking up for 2021. You know, we have the first doses of COVID-19 vaccinations being distributed, and this is shining light on the economic recovery, and hopefully that will continue. And the price of oil has certainly responded accordingly. A few dips and ups and downs, but still we're nearing $50 a barrel. So definitely a bright spot there compared to where we started out the year. So hopefully that will continue, and we'll see the price of oil and gas go up and our royalty checks continue to go back up and recover. And despite all of the challenges that we've had this year, we've had some amazing guests and really covered some high impact topics this year. And so what we wanted to do today was share a few of these clips from some of our favorite and most useful episodes this year. And Justin, I was just amazed at going through the catalog and looking at the episodes in 2020 and just the amazing guests we've talked to.
It's been absolutely wonderful. I mean, as far as sharing information, we've had some of the best guests you can ask for.
Yeah, some of the most popular episodes that we've had so far, in fact, and we'll talk about that here in a second. And you know, again, if you're just joining us for the first time, welcome. And for those of you that have been listening from the beginning, you know, thank you as well. And these episodes may be a great reminder for those of you who have listened for a while and who have listened to them before, but then they also will be hopefully a teaser for those of you who might want to go back and listen to the entire episodes that we're going to talk about. And if you listen to any episodes from 2020, this list that we're going to go through today is a great place to start. They cover everything from how large mineral buyers approach mineral rights acquisitions and a peek underneath the hood, so to speak, in that area. So that was really unique. We had strategies that we've talked about for leasing or selling your minerals. We talked about how you can gain access to free oil and gas well information across multiple states for the first time ever. Our interview with John Farrell with Well Database talked about how oil and gas prices work and break down the collapse in oil prices in 2020 and kind of all the factors that led into that, and then the factors that would lead to the recovery and going forward, what might happen. We talked to, you know, some amazing authors, amazing hosts of other shows. It was just a really cool year from that standpoint. So like I said, today we're going to do a recap, and you're going to actually hear clips from some of our favorite episodes. So Justin, let's dive into the first one. What do you have?
All right, let's do it. So first up here, we have a clip from episode 73, where we interviewed Alex Epstein, who is the author of the New York Times bestselling book, The Moral Case for Fossil Fuels. It helped us take a look at the big picture around energy, the environment, and private property rights. This hit close to home here in Colorado, where the minimum setback from occupied structures to new oil and gas wells was increased from 500 to 2,000 feet. And there's a lot of concern that this will place some mineral rights off limits to future development. Here's a clip from our conversation with Alice Epstein.
So you mentioned the history of pollution law and the competing approaches of protecting individuals' rights to be protected from pollution while recognizing the right to pursue a modern industrial life along with energy that life requires. As you know, the main focus of the show is really around the subject of private property rights as it relates to the minerals and energy below the surface of the earth. We'd love to get your thoughts on the subject and how it relates to allowing humans to flourish. So we're extremely fortunate in the United States, for those that don't know, to have the ability to own mineral rights and to enjoy the benefits of being able to develop them to use the plentiful energy that is underground. Environmental groups and climate alarmists seem dead set on stopping the use of all fossil fuels. What's interesting about this in the U.S. is that this could result in the theft of property rights under the guise of protecting the environment and ironically protecting humans. For example, in Colorado, we're in the middle of this where regulations are under consideration that would place a large amount of private mineral rights off limits to future development by increasing setbacks from buildings to where oil and gas facilities can be located. One of the main arguments that we hear is that environmentalists use air pollution and the downstream impacts that are negative to human health. From a philosophical point of view, who should decide how the land is to be used? And is there a way to do this harmoniously?
Yeah, that's a really good and big question. So I think the first thing to say is that private property rights are fundamental to human flourishing. And I don't use that lightly. Like the ability to own property and then you use your own judgment in terms of what to do about it, that's really the only way human beings can take control of their survival and their happiness. And you see this in the realm of energy production, where the fact that the U.S. has private ownership of the subsurface has just led us to a completely different trajectory of value creation than other places. You see this most recently with the shale revolution, where we have this ability to own and thus do rational things with the subsurface. And so we have a much more explored subsurface than other places. And we make all these different discoveries and different innovations. And you see in other places, just the government can say, oh yeah, the crown owns everything. And so don't investigate anything. And in the history of oil, interestingly, one of the early innovators in oil, a guy named Abraham Gesner, was in Canada and they had subsurface owned by the crown. And so he wanted to pursue certain ideas with petroleum, but he couldn't. So he moved to the US and pursued them here. So just, it's so important what you're focusing on with property rights. And I think that it's really important for those of us who believe in property rights to advocate it morally and to say, look, this is my property. Like I created value, you know, either to buy this property or originally what happened is somebody created value with the property to earn it in the first place. That's how homesteading and other different kinds of things happen. So this belongs to me and I have the right to use it as I judge best, unless I'm violating the rights of other people. But then you really have to clearly define what are the rights of other people, and you need thresholds of rights violations that are rational and they're not biased against fossil fuels. So it can't be, oh, it's a violation of rights to make noise if you're producing fossil fuels, but if you're building a movie theater or something, you can make three times more noise and it's not a violation of rights. So one of the principles of defining threshold of rights violations is being equitable. And you know, the attacks on fossil fuels are certainly not equitable. If you take something like the setbacks, like there is no legitimacy at all to say that, oh, you're a danger to people if you're not within that crazy long distance. And I think that private property owners need to say, look, you are stealing my property by doing this. This is irrational. If you have evidence that I'm endangering somebody, then you can, you know, take me to court. If I do something wrong, then I can be punished, but you can't deprive me of my property rights. And I think Colorado is a good battleground for this. And I would really like to see more of these arguments because they're right, but also because they're justice-based arguments. And justice-based arguments are very, very powerful, and they're very underutilized by the oil and gas industry.
Sure. And to kind of continue on that, you know, is it a matter of people just educating themselves and being willing to stand their ground? Or is there other things that people can do to help share the facts about how fossil fuels make life better or to protect their private property?
Well, I mean, certainly there's a lot they can learn about how fossil fuels make life better. And I know we're going to talk about this at some point. I put up a website recently called energytalkingpoints.com that has a lot of facts about this that are easy to share and quick references. So just check out energytalkingpoints.com. There's a lot about fracking there, for instance. So there's that, and that's important as part of the context. But it's also just really important to make this moral argument that, like, this is my property. I get to do with it what I choose. I think this is right. You know, it'd be a very different world if you had all these property owners saying, hey, this is my choice. And part of it is this is a moral choice. I'm helping contribute to something that all of you criticizing me are benefiting from hypocritically. So that's part of how you make the case that it's not only your right to do it, but it's actually morally the right thing. And when you have those two together, that's a powerful combination.
Okay, so that was an awesome episode. And like you mentioned, you know, there was just he unpacked a lot around the private property rights. His website, energytalkingpoints.com, he's still keeping that up to date even after the election. So that's a great resource for any mineral owner that wants to stay on top of, you know, the real issues and what's going on as it relates to your minerals and royalties and private property rights. And, you know, what are the real facts around oil and gas development. So highly recommend checking out that website. Also, that episode was, I think, so impactful. It'd be awesome if we could play the full one here, just because there were some really amazing and thought-provoking ideas that we discussed with Alex. And if there's one book that I would recommend all mineral and royalty owners read, it would be The Moral Case for Fossil Fuels. And especially if you're like me, you struggle with the news around climate change and the continued production of oil and gas to meet our needs in modern society. And that versus the development and production of oil and gas. And if you have ever thought about that kind of moral argument internally, then you really need to read this book, because he really does a good job of breaking it down, really highlighting the relevant facts there. And again, you can find a link to his book in the show notes for episode 73, which we played a clip of, or on the resources page at mineralrightspodcast.com.
And there with you, Matt. Couldn't suggest more. It was absolutely wonderful to listen to, and a wonderful viewpoint for looking at it. And his website also offers some wonderful talking points for people who may be having that conversation.
Definitely. And that book was one that we read before that interview. I'd actually had a copy for a while, but just hadn't got around to reading it. And boy, I was sure glad that I read it. And I wish I had read it sooner, actually. So you can pick that up. You know, again, we have a link on the resources page at mineralrightspodcast.com. Okay, so Justin, my first one that I was thinking back on was episode 45, which is behind the scenes at a large mineral company with Will Cullen, who's the vice president of Long Point Minerals, LLC. And I'll tell you what, this was an amazing episode. And I was looking through the statistics. In fact, it is actually the most popular episode to date in terms of the number of downloads. So Will, if you're out there listening to this, thanks again for coming on the show. You've got the trophy for the most popular episode so far. We'll see if we can unseat that in 2021 with some of the amazing guests we have lined up. But it's going to be some big shoes to fill, that's for sure. So, Justin, what did you think about this episode?
I thought it was fascinating to understand how the mineral buyer is going about assessing a deal. You know, what better could you ask for if you're potentially looking at that than to know how the other side of the table works?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's definitely, like I mentioned earlier, a peek under the hood. So you really get to get into the thought process of, you know, when you pick up the phone and talk to a mineral buyer, if you're looking at selling, you know, what are the things that they're looking at as it relates to your property, and why do they place a certain value on one property versus another? And so Will breaks down all of that stuff. You know, Long Point is one of the major end buyers in the minerals and royalty space, and they've closed over 1,200 transactions and acquired over 127,000 net royalty acres, like you mentioned in this episode, since they started in 2016. And that's mostly in Oklahoma and Texas where they're active. And I'm sure that those numbers have gone up since then. And so, again, you'll really want to listen carefully to what Will has to say and take some notes. You know, if you want to understand better about how your minerals and royalties are valued, he really talks about the biggest factors that impact the value and, you know, some strategies and tips that you can take as a mineral owner to maximize the value that you get when you're thinking about leasing or selling. So that's later in the episode. But this clip here we're going to play talks about, you know, how they underwrite mineral acquisitions.
Right. Yeah, well, because when you look at putting that valuation together, you know, you're putting together lots of items. So you have how many wells you think are going to be drilled in total to develop the resource, what the rate will be from those wells, how much those wells will ultimately pull out of the ground in terms of oil and natural gas. You have to have some sort of thought around price. I think typically a lot of people will use a strip pricing. They may have their own internal number, But what we found is the biggest lever out of all those assumptions that go into valuing these minerals is development timing. And so you can have the best rock, you can have, you know, a really great operator, but if that operator doesn't come and drill on that particular part of land for, say, 10 years, the time value of money for that 10-year gap of no activity just really destroys the value and erodes it down to a pretty minimal number. And so that's why a lot of companies will focus in on the near-term indicators, because it gives them some sort of comfort, gives them some sort of at least seeable path where they know, okay, I know I'm not going to get the timing exactly right. You know, unless I am the operator myself, I don't know if they're going to drill that this year or next year or 5 years from now. But I know if there's permits in place, or I know if they've made some other regulatory filings, or I know if I've seen some drilling pattern and they seem to be following some sort of logic in terms of how they're going across the field, and I can kind of figure out logically where they're going to be next. Those types of things at least allow you to put some bookends, some parameters on what you think that timing is going to be. Without that, you're really making some pretty blind guess. And you may be in the ballpark and you may not, but that's why people focus in on that. It's what gives them comfort. It's what allows them to, like I said, sort of put some parameters around that time.
Absolutely. And, you know, would it be safe to say that really it helps to manage your return on investment and to be sure that you are going to have some in the near future?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's the biggest thing. I mean, we're backed by Canadian Pension Plan Investment Board. And so they're interested in yield and return. And so for sure, all of our investments, everything that we buy when we're buying minerals has to fit a certain profile in terms of what we think the ultimate return is going to be. Again, we don't have to get it exactly right, but you know, we do need to be in the ballpark and have a fairly good understanding of what we think is going to happen and then have that happen.
And kind of on that fact, how much do the operators play into your decision? Are there certain things you look for in an operator or certain parameters that you're looking at in that profile?
Yeah, certainly. I think the operator, the type of operator, is a very important part of the overall valuation. So I think especially in today's market where we're seeing some operators struggle, the quality of operators is absolutely key. So we're looking for operators that have a healthy balance sheet. We're looking for operators that are committed to the play. We're looking for operators that don't have so much on their plate that they can't focus in a single area. We're also looking for operators that continue to demonstrate and do what they say they're going to do. So, you know, have they put something in their press release, or have they put something in an investor presentation, or have they come out publicly and said something, and then have they executed on that? Those are the things that we really look for when we talk about operator. Certainly, the public operators provide more data, but it doesn't necessarily mean just because you're getting more data that we're going to go with a publicly traded operator than we would with a private. If we can see what we need to in terms of how healthy that operator is, what that operator's history and future development plans look like, then we're just as happy to buy underneath a private company as we are a publicly traded company.
Makes sense. And this might be getting a bit in the weeds here, but as a mineral right owner, I kind of find it overly confusing to look at the permits and have any kind of idea of when you might actually see activity based on permits or anything else that's been in that area. How do you guys go about coming up with a development schedule that would inform you guys of the likely timing for wells to come online? Is that something that you guys pay really close attention to?
We do. We use both a probabilistic and a deterministic method. So we don't figure that a permit for sure is going to, say, a drilling is going to happen within, you know, a certain time frame or at a certain date. But what we do say is we say, okay, we think that this is what generally the development timing would look like. And we then adjust the probabilities of when wells get drilled based on if we have permits or other filings that can give us some indications and give us some insights into, you know, what the future plans look like and, you know, what the operator is going to be doing. So we really kind of take that dual approach. And again, like I said, you're not going to get it right. You just try to be in the ballpark. And those things like permits and other regulatory filings really allow you to just sort of narrow your band, right? And really sort of condense down the time window in which you think that stuff's going to happen. But it doesn't allow you to pick a specific date and say, oh, yes, the rig's going to show up on this date. And now that I have that, I can get my model dialed into to that kind of specificity. It really just helps you sort of narrow your range, but it doesn't really guide you down to a specific answer.
Absolutely. And I'm sure that's a constantly changing target as market evolves and everything else that goes into this.
Yeah, no, it is. And that's why we're constantly updating our valuations. We're constantly looking at areas, seeing what operators are doing and trying to stay on top of what's happening in the basin that we're working on and what's happening with those operators, because it does change all the time. And that's the other thing too, is, you know, a permit is no guarantee, right? We've seen tons of permits expire just because somebody's filed a permit all of a sudden doesn't mean for sure that's going to get drilled. It makes it more likely than when a permit was not there, but it certainly isn't a guarantee that all of a sudden something's going to happen. And operators change their plans all the time. Well results come in that are unexpected in one area, shift their focus to another. And so, you know, nothing's really ever set in stone, and you don't know for sure until that rig shows up on location whether or not that's going to get drilled.
And you know, another thing that you commonly hear with mineral right owners is two people very close to each other in sections, and one received a higher offer than another. Can you talk a little bit about the types of things that go into reasons why one particular section might receive a higher offer than another section based on the timing of the operations or how soon it might happen?
Yeah, and I think that that's another thing that really a lot of times mineral owners don't have a lot of insight into. And it's usually something that we have to sit down, kind of have a conversation with, again, trying to be as transparent as possible and tell them why we're valuing things in one section versus another. Typically, it's not going to be because of geology. Rocks don't know boundaries such as section lines or property lines. So more often than not, it has to do with something else external other than the rock that usually is either operator related or regulatory related. And operator related can be several things. It can be certainly whether or not there's permits filed on one section versus another that gives more insight into, you know, we think activity is going to happen over in this area than it is in the neighboring property. Another might be just the way that the units and the land has laid out in terms of how the operator has created their drilling pattern and where they're going to drill those wells. So maybe in one section, it's very easy to see exactly how the operator is going to lay out their wells and how they're going to go about development, because that section, the way it's shaped, the way it's put together, the number of acres total mirrors something else that we've seen. And we can say, oh, okay, yeah, we've seen that before. This is how the operator is going to go in and do that. And maybe the neighboring section is either misshapen or doesn't fit the same parameters that those other ones fit, where we all of a sudden now it provides a question mark. And you're like, well, I'm not sure exactly how the operator is going to fit the same number of wells in there because this section is shaped differently, or these property boundaries are different than where we were in a neighboring section. And it can also be how the operator's gone in and developed prior to coming back and doing more development. So a lot of times what you'll see in this day and age is there'll be a lot of vertical wells in an area, and the operator's going back in now and drilling horizontal wells. And what you may have is that in one section, the way that the operator initially came in and drilled it provides for so many more locations for them to come in and drill subsequent wells. Whereas maybe the neighboring property on all other things looks the exact same. However, those initial older wells that they came in and drilled provide it so that the operator just can't fit as many wells, or they can't fit wells in the same pattern as they did in that neighboring section. And so that's usually what we see in terms of, you know, operator differences between two sections. It could also just be the operator themselves. If you have a high quality operator in one section versus another, that could also be playing into the difference between the two sections. The other thing is regulatory. So if for some reason there's a difference in the two properties in terms of how the Oil and Gas Commission for that particular state is looking at it, or setting out development, or setting out some of the rules of engagement. That could be another thing that's influencing how one mineral owner is getting a value and a neighboring mineral owner is getting something much different.
And we highly recommend you listen to this episode, which is episode 45. There's some amazing knowledge that Will shares and even pulls the curtain back a bit to help us understand the underwriting process within a large mineral company like Longpoint. Thanks again to Will for sharing this information. And if you're not unseated over the next year, Will, we will take autographs. Just let us know. So next up here, we have John Farrell with Well Database, who came on the show. It was episode 55 to talk about their app and how you can use their new Lite plan for free. They're disrupting the oil and gas data space with this amazing offer and modern technology to make it better. They were the first ones to offer well-level data across multiple states, including allocated production data for Texas for free, which, Matt, it was a fascinating, and I know it's a tool that you utilize.
It is a tool that I utilize. In fact, I've been a Well Database user for the past 3 years, you know, before we even thought about having John on the show. So I use it in my consulting business. So when we perform valuations, it's one of the sources of production data for performing decline curve analyses. I'm using some other tools that I use. And the thing that I really like is just it's so easy to use. It's got amazing advanced analytics. You can export data into different applications, like I mentioned. You know, the mapping functionality is really amazing. And you can create a type curve in like 30 seconds. So if any of you out there in the industry that are forecasting wells and looking at, you know, building type curves, that can be a time-consuming process. And they have some amazing tools that allow you to do that, you know, really quickly. And so if you ever find yourself in a place where you need to download oil and gas data, and, you know, you can always upgrade to that essential plan. That's the one that I use. It's $250 a month. And you can use it for however long you need it and then downgrade back to the free plan when you don't need it. So that's a pretty cool feature. You know, a lot of these other data providers, they're requiring annual contracts and prices that go up every year. You know, ever since I've been using Well Database, their prices have remained essentially the same. So that's, you know, shout out to them for making that data more accessible to the small folks. You know, you don't have to be at a big company and spend tens of thousands of dollars a year to access well data anymore. So here's John talking about how they differentiate themselves in the data space, what some of their most popular features are, and some of the amazing partnerships they've formed. What are some of the most popular ways you're seeing your users, you know, use Well Database, and kind of what are the most popular features?
So I've actually been really surprised when I came at Well Database. It was more as a service industry, from a service company standpoint, in that the service companies needed access to large amounts of data all over the country or world, more accurately. And so we were trying to be very flexible in the answers that we provided. And that actually kind of is a double-edged sword, because then you try to do everything and end up doing nothing well. So, but over time, we've refined it quite a bit. And so the cool part about what we do is that I get emails from truck drivers who use our mobile apps to find the rig locations. I get consultants who get on, utilize our month-to-month plans so that they can get on when they have work that they need to do, get the data out and move on and pause it between the gigs they have. Small mom and pops who, you know, have never been able to afford, who just use the state sites instead, and now they can use us. But, you know, as far as favorite features go, you know, the interactive mapping, the way that we can do the comparisons, whether you're comparing operators or plays or just, you know, looking at decline analysis, the ways people come at this data in so many different ways that it's really become pretty interesting to watch. And I start most of my demos asking, what do you do with data? And I get different answers every single time. So it's pretty interesting to come at it that way. But, you know, what my favorite thing, to answer your question in a very long form, is the partnerships that we've been able to do. So working with people like Beachwood or RealX or, gosh, there's been so many of them here lately. Convey 640 is another great one that we just started working with. We're working on ironing out one with Hitched. And so being able to enable some of these newer technologies and new players and startups out there, to enable them to integrate our data into their platforms, is really allowed the technology to expand. It's just not something the other players are very interested in doing. And so one of the biggest things we set out to do was to bring new technologies to the industry. And so working with those partnerships and feeding the data into those systems has probably been the most rewarding use of our features, so to speak. But yeah, there's no shortage of ways people are using the data that will amaze you.
One of the great things, Matt, too, that you hit the nail on the head. This information was really hard for most mineral owners to have access to, either because of price or because of knowledge and understanding. And Well Database has really done a great job of offering that for free. And though $250 may seem like a lot compared to the other options out there, that's a really cost-effective option for a premium subscription to information like that.
Yeah, it's a great value for sure. And I do have a YouTube video out there on how to forecast your wells and use that information to forecast royalty checks. So if you need to understand, you know, what your estimated tax payment might be from your royalties, you can calculate that and use that information there. And there's just go to my YouTube channel to find that. And then Well Database has some useful videos out there that show how to use the system that they've updated past few months. So that's out there as well. So yeah, again, if you want to continue to listen to that episode, the full episode is episode 55, where you can get oil and gas data for free with Well Database.
All right. Next up here, we have episode 48, where we talked about the secrets behind the collapse in crude oil prices, along with how crude oil prices affect oil and gas operators and how those oil prices may impact whether or not an operator might have to file bankruptcy. We also talked about the silver lining to the decrease in oil prices as it relates to the outlook for natural gas in 2021. And Matt, I have to give you a shout out. This episode was very timely. Putting this information together is not the easiest thing in the world. And you really take the effort and the time to put this together for our listeners and to make it something that they can understand when there's so many moving pieces to it.
So even companies that have hedged production for 2020, and like I mentioned, again, have that debt coming due in 2021, are going to feel the same pain if we don't see an uptick in oil prices. You know, the reason for this, because if the price of oil stays depressed through 2020 and they're having to hedge production going forward into 2021 and beyond, they're going to have to do so at lower prices based on where oil is trading in 2020. So it probably wouldn't make sense for them to do that because they would be hopeful that the price would recover. Otherwise, they're locking in barrels at lower prices. So again, like I mentioned earlier, I think we're going to see some small operators go bankrupt in 2020. Next big wave coming in 2021, unless the market recovers by then. Now, the one caveat to that is if private equity comes in and saves the day. So it could be that some of these companies that have good assets, they have a good position in a good basin, you could see private equity come in and look to pay off that debt and get in exchange for an investment in that company. Now, if they do that, then that, you know, what I just said would sort of potentially not play out fully. So some of the better companies might get saved if they have some private equity money that comes in. I think what you're going to see too, though, is the large integrated oil and gas companies being able to weather the storm better, because if they have refining divisions and chemicals, those are going to be profitable at lower oil prices because their feedstock costs are lower. And so that'll offset some of the losses that they're going to have with their exploration and production division. And so those companies will be better off, so to speak. And, you know, potentially companies with a strong balance sheet or some of these larger integrated oil and gas companies could come in and there'll be some consolidation with them gobbling up some of their weaker competitors. Now, the silver lining to all this, if you do see across the board the continuation of companies saying they're going to slash their capital budgets this year, stop drilling new wells in these oil basins, this means that there's going to be less associated natural gas that would be produced. And associated gas is basically the natural gas that's produced as a byproduct of crude oil production. And Goldman Sachs came out and said, led by Brian Singer, we estimate if our cover producers invest on the basis of $30 to $45 a barrel West Texas Intermediate over the next five quarters, we'll see more than 1 BCF a day net less U.S. gas production. So we'll see a reduction in U.S. gas production of 1 BCF a day. And that prospect of companies cutting their budgets has played out a little bit in terms of the sentiment for oil and gas. And so natural gas prices were at one point as low as $1.61. But the April NYMEX futures contract was up 7 cents on the day to settle at about $1.78. This was as of Monday when the price of oil was tanking. And this optimism has continued for at least the time of this report. The price of Henry Hub natural gas was up another almost 5% to around $1.91. So this is, you know, what you look at it at face value seemed to be kind of contrary to logic if supply and demand is where it's at. But there is actually a silver lining from a supply standpoint in that drilling fewer oil wells is going to mean less gas is produced. And so this will help operators in the gas-centric plays like the Marcellus and Utica on the East Coast in Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and Ohio, and then the Haynesville in Louisiana. And so I think what you're going to see is this helping the gas price, at least in the short term. We'll see how it plays out. But that's sort of, the silver lining to all this. That definitely was an episode to listen to if you want to understand more about how crude oil prices work and some of the, little known secrets behind that collapse that occurred earlier this year. This one, I think, was helpful just in giving a little bit of insight into how those oil prices affect an operator's ability to borrow money and to continue to drill and whether or not they might actually have to file bankruptcy if the prices continue to stay low. So lots to listen to there. Again, that was episode 48, if you want to listen to that one all the way through. And next up, we brought Spencer Cox back on the show in episode 53. And this is right around the time when we had crude oil prices go negative for the first time. And so big shout out to Spencer for coming on the show on short notice to help us break down what we needed to know about negative royalties and what are some of the options if a well that we have a royalty interest in gets shut in. And, you know, this concept of negative prices for crude oil was a new one for all of us, that's for sure. And he really broke down the concept of negative royalty payments, which I know I'm familiar with for natural gas, even before the price collapse occurred, just because of the post-production costs that get deducted from some of my royalty checks. And, you know, Spencer has some really valuable tips on there about what you should do if you get charged negative royalties. So we'll listen in to our clip from episode 53 with Spencer Cox. Spencer, I wanted to follow up. You mentioned the allowability of negative royalties varies to a certain extent from state to state. Is there a recent case law covering this issue and maybe just a quick summary of sort of where the courts stand with respect to negative royalties and, you know, maybe a few milestone cases?
Okay, well, unfortunately, there are none, at least none that we've been able to discover. And we did a search on this exact topic just a few months ago for a presentation that we did to the Texas State Bar. So when I say that it varies state to state, what I mean is that the ability for an operator to, using air quotes, pay you a negative royalty really falls under the general law of how strong protections are for lessors in your state. Most states have some variation on what in Texas we call the reasonably prudent operator rule, which in layman's terms really means as your operator being responsible. Are they making responsible decisions in marketing and selling your gas or oil? And are they making responsible decisions in drilling on your lease? So that's one. The other thing is, as I'm sure you're aware, is sort of the rule about production and paying quantities, which means that if your lease is not producing and paying quantities after the end of the primary term, then it's likely going to terminate. Now, that obviously brings negative royalties into play because if the lease is producing minerals that are, you know, have a negative value, then that's clearly not producing and paying quantities in the sense that any, you know, person on the street would think. But depending on your state, the analysis can be a little bit trickier. I know in Texas, for example, it's fairly fairly tough, or at least more difficult than other states, in that operators can and do lose money on wells for, you know, a month, 2 months, even several months in a row. But the real question is whether continued operations are prudent given expectations and all the circumstances of that particular lease or well. So when I say that it varies, what I really mean is that I think you would need to know the jurisdiction you're in, how strong or weak their lessor protections are, and then see where your particular situation falls into that that rubric.
Is there a difference, Spencer, in what's allowable for crude oil versus natural gas?
Not that I'm aware of. I would say there are small variations in the case law, but I would say that those are not fundamental differences in theory, just more in the way things can be applied to just the different industry realities of how oil and gas are marketed and the differences there. So that was the long answer. The short answer is no, not that I know of.
Speaking of, you know, if you're in the process of negotiating a lease, that's one action, I guess, that a mineral owner could take to protect their interest. Is there anything else that a royalty owner could do in the absence of, you know, of negotiating a new lease or renegotiating a lease to include language to protect them? I mean, is there any other recourse that they have to prevent being charged negative royalties for the sale of natural gas or crude, or at least to minimize the impact on that?
I don't know that there is up front. I think if an operator is going to charge you a negative royalty for whatever reason, you're not going to know about it until they've done it. And so as the royalty owner or the lessor, your next steps are, well, how do I address this and how do I mitigate it? What you can do in advance to be ready for that day, should it come, is to just be proactive about understanding what you're getting paid and why you're getting paid what you are. In a lot of respects, the royalty owner is kind of at the mercy of the operator once the lease is signed. But that doesn't mean that that you don't have any recourse if things go wrong or if there are just mistakes made. I mean, one of the very simple things you can do is just, if you think there's a problem, you can pick up the phone and call your operator's royalty relations department, and they may give you an explanation that makes sense and everybody is happy. Or it could be that there's just a simple mistake, or it could be something else. But, you know, it never hurts to pick up that phone and start asking questions if something seems off or not normal to you.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And we often talk about that, that really the first stop is should be talking to those folks. And 9 times out of 10, they want to be helpful and they want to try to get a resolve for everybody. And, you know, $1 million question of this episode. So I just got a check showing a negative royalty or payment. What should I do now?
Well, I think it breaks down to a series of things. And the first thing you need to do is investigate your check stub and understand exactly what it is that you're looking at. So we've been talking, and I think most folks are thinking about a negative royalty that's based on a negative market price. But a lot of times you'll see a negative royalty because there's been some readjustment. Maybe it's been that you've just been getting overpaid on a larger interest than what you actually own. Or it could be that you're negative for gas, for instance, say, which is something that we've seen in the Permian, but you're positive for oil and you're, you know, very much net positive on the whole. So step one is to understand exactly what it is that your check stub is showing you. And that's where, if you don't understand, you can call your operator, you can go on forums, or there are third-party consultants who can help you out, and just a lot of materials available publicly for free, and then others that don't cost much that you can start that process on. The second step is to pull out your lease and, as best you can, figure it out how it is that you're supposed to be paid. At a high level, leases fall into one of two categories. Either you have a market value royalty or you've got a proceeds royalty. If you've got a market value, you want to ask around, you know, what is everybody else getting paid? What are your neighbors getting paid if they've got leases and wells in your vicinity? What are folks reporting on the forums that they're being paid if that's information is out there for you? If you've got a little bit more sophistication, I guess, or experience, you can always go to state regulatory websites. The Texas Railroad Commission is one. In Oklahoma, it's the OCC. but every state has one, and generally they make available records that show what the operators are reporting for wellhead prices on your well and others around it. So that would be step two for me if I'm investigating a market value. For a proceeds lease, as I said, the real question comes down to, is your operator acting reasonably prudent? Which is, you know, that's the Texas language, but the standard is more or less there in every state. And it's just, hey, are they doing the right thing? Does what they are what they doing make sense? Do you know who they're selling to? Are they selling to a third party, or are they selling to an affiliate? How are they calculating your royalty? What sales price is it based on? And what are they taking for deductions, if deductions are allowed under your lease? You know, if you really want to get into the weeds, you can also look at public filings, SEC filings, for instance, investor presentations that are for your operator that may be available online. And they'll tell you, hey, is my operator hedging? Are they selling at spot? Are they doing a combination? Do they have long-term sales contracts? Just you may get some insight into their business after the minerals leave your land that will educate you a little bit on how all of that filters down into the royalty that you're receiving. But if you do those things and you still have questions that can't be answered by your operator, or maybe they don't want to give you an answer, which is, like Justin said, that I think that is rare. I think most do want to do the right thing. But if you feel like something's amiss, then it may be. And that's the point where you may consider taking all the information you've collected and going to a consultant or an attorney that you trust, someone that can help you professionally, look at this. And it may be that there's a problem, or it may be that they may be able to explain it to you in a way that makes sense and can at least give you some comfort that even if you're not getting the payment you would like, you know that your rights under the contract are at least still being respected. So quite a long list of things, but pretty much with any royalty issue that you have, it starts with, what does my check stub say? How do I read it? And what does my lease say? From there, you're well down the path to answering about any potential problem or question that you might have.
And again, if you want to listen to that full episode, that was episode 53 with Spencer Cox. As we mentioned in that episode, Burns Trust made available their white paper on negative prices and royalty calculations that they presented to the State Bar of Texas. You can go to the show notes for episode 53 at mineralrightspodcast.com for the link where you can get a free copy of that paper. And I couldn't agree more, Matt. Thank you so much, Spencer, for coming on a short notice. And you've been a wonderful resource for us, for me both personally and for the podcast as well.
Definitely. And thank you again to everybody that left a review in 2020. Again, taking the time to share how the show has helped you really helps us out and really is the one way that you can help us continue to grow the show and continue to reach all the mineral and royalty owners that need to hear this information. So thanks again for that. And then thanks again to all the guests. We had, so many amazing guests, even more than we just highlighted today. Thinking back to guests like Leanna Jones that helped us understand how title opinions work. What are some of the other guests and some of the other episodes that you can think of, Justin, that really hit home for 2020?
There were, so many of the news episodes were very interesting that we did. And then also some of the others where we talked and really got into the nitty gritty of how mineral right owners can go out and find the information and going through that process. I know when I started out with my own mineral rights, finding that information and understanding what I was looking at was not really a very easy thing. And Matt, you were my resource, and I hope people are getting the same effect from the information that we're putting out with the podcast.
I hope so too. Yeah, definitely. We'll continue to deliver this valuable content to you and look forward to 2021. Things are looking up again. I think with oil prices, we should hit $50 a barrel or continue to go a little bit higher than that. Maybe a more measured recovery in drilling activity and, just see some stability in the market. I think that would be a good thing and certainly something I would appreciate for sure.
Absolutely. And I know, Matt, you'll probably agree with this, but over 2020, we haven't been in isolation. We've spoken to so many people. So many people have reached out to us. We've reached out to people. And it's been wonderful to get to know people, even if they don't end up on the show, that are in the industry and surrounding the oil and gas industry.
Yeah, that's a great point. So, continue to send emails to us, feedback@mineralrightspodcast.com. Whether you have a question that you would like help with, or if you work in the industry and just want to connect, you know, reach out to us. And then who knows, we're looking at always having, you know, amazing guests on the show. So if you're a good fit, we might reach out and see if you can be a guest. But if that is of any interest to you, please reach out. Or if you just want to say hi, just definitely send us an email at feedback@mineralrightspodcast.com.
Well, thanks, Matt. It's been a wonderful 2020, and I look forward to what 2021 will hold for the podcast.
Likewise. And, you know, a big shout out to Justin as well. You know, thank you again for all of your help with this show, and really wouldn't be the same without you. You know, you definitely add a lot of value and a lot of insight from someone that's dealt with a lot of these issues that we talk about on the show, just in going through the process of managing your family's portfolio of minerals and royalties. So thank you again for your commitment and time. You know, definitely appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Matt. It's been a wonderful learning experience, and every question asked by a listener and every guest we have, I learn something new, which is invaluable.
Well, thank you as well. And we'll talk to everybody next year, 2021. Here we come.
Here we come.
Thanks again.
Thanks so much for listening to the Mineral Rights Podcast with your host, Matt Sands. Don't forget to subscribe and share at mineralrightspodcast.com. The Mineral Rights Podcast should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy.